Welcome everyone who's here this morning. If you're visiting with us, we're glad you're here, and we'd like for you to come back and be with us every time you have the opportunity to do so. I'm going to talk about something this morning that I believe is common. It's perhaps common to all people. It is certainly common to all Christians who are members of the church for any length of time. And I'm going to begin by looking in the Old Testament. If you're open to the book of Psalms, stay there with me, and if you will, go back a page or so to Psalm 7. These two Psalms, traditionally, I'm not necessarily convinced that this is so, but don't have a real reason to doubt it. But these two Psalms traditionally have been written by David. That part I think is certain. But written by David in reference to the persecution that he was receiving from King Saul. Perhaps we know more about King David, certainly in the Old Testament, more about him than any other Old Testament character. The material that's devoted to David is quite extensive, and you can read that story. And we know that David went through an ordeal that lasted perhaps some 13 years or so, in which God had chosen him. He was going to be king. He was already anointed so. God had rejected King Saul, and Saul knew it. And as time goes on, the hatred from Saul intensified against David, and therefore the persecution that Saul levied against David grew. And traditionally, as I say, these two psalms, the one that Bill just read for us in Psalm 11, and again here in Psalm 7 that we're going to look at, grow out of David turning to God as a child of God would do, and appealing to God both for justice, for care, and exclaiming his trust in God, his belief in God during that time of persecution. I want you to read with me in Psalm 7. I want to read it, and I'm going to focus on maybe three, four verses out of it in particular. And then I want to go to the New Testament and look at a number of passages. David begins in Psalm 7 and verse 1, "O Lord my God, in thee do I put my trust." He says, "Save me from all them that persecute me and deliver me." Now I believe basically that's the cry of a Christian. To trust in God, to put his trust in God, and to believe that God will deliver him, albeit it may have to run its course, but God will deliver him from those who persecute him. He goes on to say, "Lest he tear my soul like a lion, rending it in pieces while there is none to deliver. O Lord my God, if I have done this, if there be iniquity in my hands." And he begins to talk about the fact that if all of this is coming because of the sin that he has, and you have to remember, this is if indeed it is right that he is writing it during this time, David would have been very faithful at this point in his life. This is well before the Bathsheba incidents and all of that kind of thing. He was very faithful, very strong. And so he begins to exclaim to God, if I've done wrong, if this is coming because I've done wrong, if I've rewarded evil, verse 4, unto him that was at peace with me. And he goes on with that. Then let it happen, he says, verse 5. In other words, if this is chastisement, if I'm being chastised for doing wrong, then let it come. But then he says, verse 6, "Arise, O Lord, in thine anger." And I think one of the things that we have to remember is that when God's people are persecuted, and we're going to read some New Testament passages along this line, but when God's people are persecuted, it makes God angry. It does stir the wrath of God. And it doesn't go unnoticed by God. It's not something that God just takes lightly. It's not something that God just overlooks or sleeps through and to kind of bend a passage. But it is something that God notices. And it is something that God gets angry about. "Arise, O Lord, in thine anger. Lift up thyself because of the rage of mine enemies. And awake for me to the judgment that thou hast commanded. So shall the congregation of the people compass thee about. For their sakes, therefore, return thou on high." Then notice verse 8. "The Lord shall judge the people." And then he says to God, confidently I believe, "Judge me, O Lord, according to my righteousness and according to mine integrity that is in me." If a person is doing right, and you're here this morning, you look within your heart, you look within your soul, you know whether or not you're doing right. If to the best of your ability, you know whether or not you are being faithful to God, doing what you can, doing what you know, and striving to learn more of what God would have you to do, and giving your all to do that. You know that. Or you know if you're not. And if you are, and if because, directly, because you are doing that, as David was, if directly you are doing that, and because of that, you're being persecuted, as David perhaps was by Saul, then you have right. You have a right to look to God. It is right to look to God and say to God, judge me according to your righteousness, according to my integrity. Integrity has to do with knowing you're right and doing the best you can. It's like Paul saying, making the comment that he'd lived in all good conscience to this day. Even right or wrong, to the best of his ability, he had done his best to do what's right. Now you'll notice he goes on to say, David does here in verse 9, "Oh, let the wickedness of the wicked come to an end, but establish the just." And I believe that what you understand when you pray to God is that it will run its course. That the persecution will come, and it will be finished by God. And he is saying to God, let the wickedness of the wicked end. But on the other hand, establish the just. For the righteous God trieth the hearts and reins. God looks inwardly. God knows who's right and who's not. We often, down here on this earth, we often contend with each other. We, maybe both of us feel strongly about things. And sometimes a person who is not thinking clearly, who's not thinking rightly, will be very angry about something. And as Saul was, and in their wrath, carried away in that wrath, will lash out and do this or do that. And yet what David is saying here is, I trust you, God. You look into the hearts of people, you know the difference. You know who is right with you, who is not. You have to love and appreciate verse 10. It is a beautiful verse. It's a powerful verse. When he says, my defense is of God. Years ago, it's been years now, but years ago, I knew of a man just carried away in his wrath. He was wrong. He was in sin. The church had disciplined this man, and he didn't take it well. He grew, his wrath intensified. And he began to focus that wrath on different members, different individuals who were members of the congregation who had withdrawn from him. He got violent. He would ambush, is what I would call it, but lay in wait somewhere, catch a person off guard. He was a big man, physically, and he would generally pick upon the smallest members of the congregation, the smallest men. He'd beat them up, that kind of thing. And I remember when he attacked a particular individual. I wasn't there, because naturally he would wait till he caught someone alone. But he attacked a particular individual, and this individual said to him exactly what David said here. And he started threatening, I'm going to do this to you, I'm going to do that to you. And this individual said, my defense is of God. And meant it. Believed it and meant it. My defense is of God. I mean, you can, if God so allows, it's just like the three Hebrews, when Nebuchadnezzar was going to do this and going to do that and throw them in the fiery furnace. You can do that if God allows. But if God doesn't, you can die instantly on the spot. My defense is of God. And no matter what you think you will do, only God is in absolute control. My defense is of God who saves the upright in heart. God judges the righteous. And God is angry with the wicked. It's interpolated, but I believe that's the idea. God is angry with them every day. If he turn not, he will whet his sword. If he had bent his bow and made it ready, he has also prepared for him the instruments of death. He ordaineth his arrows against the persecutors. When you read this, you realize what David is saying. Language of his day, but we don't miss it. God is armed. God is ready. And God is certainly capable of effecting judgment when he chooses against the person who persecutes the righteous. Because he travails. Notice this in verse 14. Interesting language. He travails with iniquity and has conceived mischief. It's like it is a life within him. The persecutor has a life of evil that is born, conceived within him, and growing. And I think we've seen that. I believe that we've known individuals, probably all of us, but certainly some of us, have known individuals that become evil, become persecutors as it were, and you see the evil just growing in them. And it grows to the point that it takes on, as we sometimes say, or at least we did down south, it takes on a life of its own. I believe David describes that here. He's made a pit and digged it, verse 15, and fallen into the ditch which he made. His mischief shall return upon his own head, and his violent dealing shall come down upon his own pate, or the crown of his head, top of his head. As for David, verse 17, I will praise the Lord according to his righteousness. I will sing praise to the name of the Lord Most High. He's not defeated by it. When you look at the story of David, if indeed this is about Saul, probably is, you don't see a defeated individual. You don't see an individual that's carried away in distress. You see an individual that gets down at times without any doubt. But he's not carried away in that distress. And he believes in God and he believes in the deliverance from God. Persecution is a fact of life. I want you to go with me to the New Testament. Let's look at Matthew chapter 5, what we commonly call the Sermon on the Mount. If you've been reading the bulletin and following that, you know that I'm kind of doing paragraph by paragraph, just a little tiny overview of the Sermon on the Mount, paragraph by paragraph. And when you look at Matthew chapter 5, the very beginning of it, when Jesus, verse 2, opened his mouth and began to teach it, the first thing that he did was deliver these Beatitudes. First invitation on a Wednesday night I called them the Beatitudes. You know, Beatles, Beatitudes, but the Beatitudes. And these are where God tells us why we are blessed. We are blessed. We are happy. We are approved of God. All of those ideas within that word. Because of these characteristics. And one of the things that Jesus says, in fact, the one that he pays the most attention to, in other words, in length of terms here, Or whatever. Spends more time on. I'm not sure how I wanted to say that. But anyway, that he spends more time on. Three verses. Look with me at verse 10. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake. It's a fact of Christian life. You do what's right, somebody ain't going to like it. You do what's right, somebody is going to take exception to it. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are ye, Jesus says to his disciples, verse 11. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you. The word revile has to do with literally speaking against, but I used to say it like this, and I think this conveys the idea. It's just speaking nasty. And when I say speaking nasty, it's just that you say the most vile things. That's why the word is revile. You say the most vile things against us. In other words, your speech is designed to hurt. Whatever you know tears at a person. Whatever you know can get inside a person and hurt them to their very core. That's the kind of thing you say. You taunt people. You challenge people to do things against even their will or against their nature, but you challenge it. You hurl insults at someone. That's reviling. Jesus makes the point here in verse 11, when blessed are you when men shall persecute you and shall revile you. And then notice, and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely. It's not true. And deep down inside you know it's not true, but it hurts. It hurts just the same. Shall say all manner of evil against you falsely, and then notice the phrase, for my sake. You're a Christian. You're a Christian doing what's right. You're a Christian giving every attempt at doing exactly what the Lord wants, and someone hates you for it. And you look at the example, and I'm not going to turn to it, but we could. Obviously, when you see reviling, you probably think of, and I certainly think of, Jesus being reviled during the crucifixion. And I think of all those things that were said to Jesus. I mean, when you stop and look at all of that kind of thing, if you're this and if you're that, doesn't that hurt? I mean, when you're making sacrifices and doing your best to do what's right, One of the things that gets to you as much as anything, at least it does to me, is when someone says, if you're, you know, if you're a preacher, if you're a Christian, if you're this, if you believe in God, and you've done nothing but give your life to believing in God. You've given your life to preach. You've given your life to be a Christian. You've given your life to do what's right. If you're so and so. It just dismisses your whole life. And so they did with Jesus. If you're the Son of God. What had he ever done on a daily basis to show anything else? If you're the Son of God, do this, do that. If this man were a prophet. If this man were a prophet. How many things had he predicted? How many things had he predicted about that very night that they were proving? It dismisses everything about you. It's hurtful. And yet, it's the defense, it's the offense, maybe is a better term for it, that the persecutor will run to. When you look at what Jesus is saying here, Jesus is just stating a fact. I want you to go with me to a book. I don't want to spend a great amount of time, but I do want to take a few minutes with it. Go with me to the book of 2 Timothy. To me, 2 Timothy is a sad book. Now, there are books in the Bible that are not sad. Philippians is not a sad book. Yes, Paul's in prison, but it's not a sad book. It's a very happy book, and it's a very powerful book, and it's a book that makes you just feel better when you read the book. But to me, 2 Timothy is a sad book. I get sad every time I read it. I don't know how many times I have read it, but every time I get sad. And here's why. Because you know the setting of 2 Timothy is the Apostle Paul. And you know that it is the Apostle Paul who's given perhaps at this time somewhere on the order of 35 years as an apostle. Arrested and put in prison in Rome for the second time. Going to die. There's any question about that. 2 Timothy chapter 4 tells you that explicitly. He knows it. He knows he is going to die. And it's a book in which he writes back to his young, closest friend that has become his son that he never would have, I mean, physically in this life. But Timothy has in every respect become his son. And he writes back to Timothy, and it is like you, if you as a parent knew you were going to die and you're separated from the person you're the closest to on this earth, you want to see them. I mean, we want that person to be close to us. But you listen to the book and all of that, said all of that to say this. That's not what's the saddest part of it. The fact that he's alone and the fact that he's separated from his loved ones is not the saddest part. The saddest part is that he has dedicated his life and given his life, and so many people are against him. When you read the book, you listen to the language of Paul. I want you to go with me to chapter 3 for a moment. He says this to Timothy. As he talks about, you know, the last days, and he describes the, verse 1, the perilous times that shall come. Those dangerous times that surely will come during the last days. We're living that. And he talks about the way people are. The fact that they're traitors. They can't keep their word, and they don't. You can't trust them. They're not good. They're bad. And he talks about all of that. He talks about the futility of educated people who, and spiritually so, I think he means directly, ever learning, verse 7, and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. But as he describes all of that, he says this, verse 10, and this is very sad. He says to Timothy, you have fully known my doctrine. That's what he is. That's what he stands for. When we think of Paul, the first thing we think of is Paul believed this. Paul said that. You've known my doctrine. You've known my manner of life. You know, you live with someone, you know their manner of life. I mean, it gets way past. And I want you to please understand what I'm saying. Listen carefully. When you live with someone, it gets way past what they do or what they say at the moment. You know their manner of life. You learn to distinguish in that person the difference between whether or not this is the way they are, or they're just having a bad moment. You know the difference. Now Paul says to Timothy, you've been with me enough, you know my manner of life. Does that mean he never made a mistake? Of course not. That's what he's saying. You know what I am. And what he was good. You know my manner of life. You know my purpose. Do you have a purpose? And could someone say of you, your purpose is to get through this life serving God and go to heaven. That's your purpose. You've known my purpose. You've known my faith. You've known my long suffering. How long tempered. We talk about being short tempered. The word really has the idea of being long tempered. How much did Paul have to put up with? You know? And how long tempered about it was he? You've known my love. You've known my patience. My endurance is the idea. But now notice verse 11. Sadly, you've known my persecutions. When Paul met Timothy, in all likelihood, when Timothy was converted, in all likelihood, somebody was trying to literally kill Paul. And that's how their life together began. You go back to Acts and you can read in Acts 13, 14, 15, 16. You see the time of Timothy and all of that. And you'll see what I'm talking about. People were trying to kill him. And that was the beginning. And for the next 35 years, or let's say 35 years, but some of it had already taken place. But for the next, whatever, 25 or so that Timothy was involved with Paul, it seemed like every time you're turning around, somebody's trying to kill Paul. Somebody's against Paul. Somebody hates Paul. Somebody wants to destroy Paul. Somebody wants to destroy Paul's credibility. Somebody wants to laugh at Paul. Somebody wants to make fun of Paul. Paul is saying, you've known my persecution. I'm not going to list them here, but you've been there and you've seen it. It's like that person you're married to, or that child of yours, that adult child of yours, or that best friend of yours, and they've just been with you and they've seen it and they know, and you don't have to say it. You just look at them and in a general term, you've known my persecutions, and immediately 100 stories start running through their mind. They've known it. They've seen it. You've known my afflictions. Some of that from other people. Some of that health-wise. You've known that. And he even says here, which came to me at Antioch and Iconium and Lystra. That's Timothy's home area. That's like if somebody were to say to me, you know, or I were to say something, say to somebody like, maybe an Andy Owens, known for 30 years. And I would say, you know what happened in Birmingham and Cullman and Decatur and Athens. And I wouldn't have to say any more. He was there. He knows. It's that kind of thing. And then he says this to Timothy. Persecutions, afflictions that came to me at Antioch, Iconium, Lystra. What persecutions I endured, and out of them all, the Lord delivered me. Now that's not sad. That part is beautiful. It's wonderful. But then he says this in verse 12. Yea, or yes, and all that will live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution. But evil men and seducers will wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. I believe what Paul is saying is this. You might disagree with this, I don't know. But I believe Paul is saying this. You live godly, and you're going to pay for it. You live godly, and somebody is not going to like it. You live godly, and you demonstrate your godliness, and people are going to take exception to it. You live godly, and you're going to be persecuted. And in fact, if you're not being persecuted, it is almost like this. If you're not being, and you never have been, then you haven't been living godly. That would logically follow from what he's saying here. So the point is this. Godliness begets persecution. It is part of it. And when you look at this book, what is so sad to me is that that's Paul's life. Now, when I say that, don't misunderstand. Paul would not have said that. Paul would have said, my life is to live Jesus Christ. It has been living Jesus Christ. I've lived a great life. I'm going to heaven. You can't beat that. But when you look at his life, what is so sad about it is that he reaches the end of his life and what he should have had. Just like Jesus. I mean, you know, you travel around, you think of Jesus. He traveled around. What did he do that was so bad? He taught people how to live better. He taught people how to be better. He healed people. Blind people saw, lame people walked. He lifted people's spirits. He made them better than they were before. He took people who were in sin, abject lives of sin. The woman in Luke 7. the woman and John 8. And he lifted them up out of that and put them on a road of living a good life, a better life. What is so bad about that? What's so wrong in all of that? And people hated him. He hated him to the point that even Pilate, a Roman who cared nothing for God or religion, but a Roman recognized it and said he hadn't done anything. And they hated him. And Paul is no different. And so he reaches the end of his life and he says, Timothy, you've known. You sum up my life and you've known the persecutions. And you think of some of the specific things he says here. Look at chapter 4. In chapter 4, one of the saddest things there can ever be, in verse 10, for Demas has forsaken me. Now I want you to notice that phrase. Not just Demas has become unfaithful. Not just Demas is no longer a faithful Christian. This is personal. You can look elsewhere, Colossians 4 for example. You can look elsewhere and see that Demas was once a co-worker. Demas was a person Paul had trust in. Demas was a person who worked alongside Paul. Demas has forsaken me, he says. And that hurts. And to have to die with that being the case. In fact, he goes on here and he lists some people and says this in verse 11. Only Luke is with me. For all that Paul had done, all the difference Paul had made in countless lives. How many people were Christians because this man gave his life to serving Jesus Christ? Now he's in Rome, now he's about to die, and nobody's there. Nobody cares. You look back at chapter 1. I might miss this point, I'm not sure. But you look back at chapter 1, and part of it you can't miss. When he says this in verse 15 to Timothy, this you know, that all they which are in Asia, three missionary journeys we're told about in Asia, three missionary journeys of going around to preach the gospel with people stoning him and beating him, people trying to kill him, three missionary journeys, and now they all turn away from him. That's his life. That's why it's so sad to me. All they that are in Asia, which are in Asia, be turned away from me. I think he probably means doctrinally, and that to Paul would have been more hurtful even than turning away from him personally. But I might be wrong about that. Regardless, they've turned away. They've all turned away from me. How sad is that? That many times is a Christian life. When you think of what the Bible teaches about persecution, I want you to read with me in 1 Peter chapter 4. And I think of this passage from time to time. 1 Peter chapter 4, and I want you to read together with me beginning in verse 12, because it cautions us of the way we should see it. It said it's a part of life. It's a part of Christian life, and I believe that. And Peter says it this way, beginning in verse 12. Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you. Now when I read of that, I don't know what you think about it. When I read that, I think of those three in Nebuchadnezzar's furnace. But regardless, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you or test you, as though some strange thing happened unto you. I mean, we're shocked by it. You think of the conditions there in 2 Timothy. When people fall away from the truth, I think it does me. It shouldn't. And I always find myself saying, it shouldn't shock you, but it does. When somebody forsakes you personally, I'm always shocked at it. I shouldn't be by this point in life, but I always am. When someone turns away, as he describes it there, I'm always surprised. And maybe that's because I want to believe the best about people. I want to believe in people. I guess I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if I didn't. I want to see people as good. I want to believe that they're good. I want to believe the best about them. I want to believe that everybody I meet that gives me any indication whatsoever that they're interested in the truth and they want to do what's right, that they're telling the truth. And I'd rather be that than become so cold and cynical that it gets to the point I don't believe in anybody or anything. And yet, when it happens, it's not a strange thing. And as Peter goes on to say here, Don't think it's strange when it happens. But rejoice, verse 13. Inasmuch as you are partakers of Christ's sufferings, that when His glory shall be revealed, you may be glad also with exceeding joy. If you be reproached, that's what Jesus was talking about. They say all manner of evil against you falsely, and they revile you and so forth. When you're reproached for the name of Christ, happy are you. Same word. Blessed are you. For the Spirit of glory and of God rest upon you. On their part, He is evil spoken of. On your part, He is glorified. And isn't that what counts? I mean, in the end, if someone hates you for doing right, but God loves you, isn't that what counts? In the end, if someone disapproves of you, I can think of a family member right now, a very close family member, blood-wise, that hates the very thought of me because I stand up here this morning and I preach. And it's because of the lifestyle this person lives and because I believe it's wrong. But if because you stand for what's right, someone hates you, but God loves you. Someone's against you, but God is for you. Someone disapproves of you, but God approves of you. If for what you are and what you live and what you stand for, what you teach, what you say, what you do, if for all of that God accepts you, but someone here on earth dismisses you, what Peter is saying is be happy about it. Glorify in it. Glorify God on this behalf. Let none of you suffer as a murderer or a thief or an evildoer or a busybody in other men's matters. But if any of you suffer as a Christian, the word Christian is only used three times, and this is one of them. If any man suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God on this behalf. For the time has come that judgment must begin at the house of God. And on what basis does God separate those that He really accepts and those He doesn't? It's on the basis of those who are willing to stand for what they believe in. Who are willing to act no matter what kind of reception they get from somebody else. The Bible teaches us that persecution is a part of life. I want to close by looking at one story. And you might find it an odd one that I would turn to, and yet it is a story that I believe really, really rings with the idea of what goes on. I want you to turn with me to the book of John. And this story is, to me, it is typical. It's typical of life. It's typical of people. Probably it is typical of, you know, of what happened during Jesus' life. But it's the story in John chapter 9. And it is the story, remember, and I want to spend a long time with it here because I only want to read one small section of it. But it is the story where Jesus healed. Remember the man that was blind from birth, and he came upon this individual and the disciples wanted to know who had done wrong. And Jesus made the point that it was neither that the man sinned, verse 3, nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest. And he goes on, remember, to heal the man, the young man, but he goes on to heal the man. Now, if you remember this story, the man that now able to see, the man goes into the synagogue here, into the meeting, and all the Pharisees are there and all of that kind of thing. And I want you to drop down with me to, down about verse 23, 24 here. And this is where they're questioning his parents in the synagogue. You can see that in verse 22. And the parents basically say in verse 23, he's old enough, ask him. In other words, what about all of this? You've been healed. You know, tell us about all of this. Because it's the Sabbath day, remember, and that's their contention. Now start reading with me in verse 24, and I want us to see this. Then again called they the man that was blind and said unto him, give God the praise. Do they mean that? Give God the praise. We know that this man with the power of God to heal blindness. We know that this man is a sinner. I want you to let that phrase just soak in for a moment. You know that an individual who has the power from God to heal blindness is a sinner? How ludicrous a statement is that? And yet, is that not exactly the kind of statement that we hear from people being irrational, being illogical, who want to be against us, whatever it is we're doing, who want to be against us for what it is that we're doing right? What comes pouring forth out of their mouth makes no sense. We know this man is a sinner. Incredible. I mean, it's almost not to be believed. Now, don't misunderstand, I believe it. I'm just saying people are not to be believed. Now, he goes on here. He answered and said, verse 25, now he, the young man, the healed young man, he's logical, he's rational, he's righteous. He answers them, whether he be a sinner or not, I don't know. But one thing I do know, whereas I was blind, now I see. I mean, that's just as straightforward and honest as it can be. You judge it. I can see. But does that tell you something? Can't you begin to see? And you know, it's like sometimes you want to look at somebody, you see it, it is so clear, it is so black and white, it is so perfectly understandable, you can see it, you just want to shake an individual and say, can't you get it? And they can't. And they don't. They said unto him again, what did he do to you? How did you get so messed up? How in the world could you get so messed up? How did he open your eyes? He answered them, verse 27, I told you already, and you didn't hear. You're listening, we would sometimes say to people. You're not listening to me. Wherefore would you hear it again? Why would you hear it if I told you again? Will you also be his disciples? Will you enroll at Jesus' feet? Will you listen to Jesus? Now he goes on here. Verse 28, they reviled him. That's what you resort to. If you can't answer someone, if the logic is there and you can't argue against it, what do? You revile. That's the way we are as human beings. That's the nature. You attack. They reviled him. And they said, you are his disciple. We are Moses' disciples. We're better than that. How many times have you faced someone? How many times have you tried to teach someone? How many times have you tried to tell someone who was wrong that they are wrong? And they will begin to revile you, and they will begin to talk about how you might be a whatever. You might be thus and so, but I am. And they will begin to tell you how much better they are than you. And you just shake your head. You look at their lives. You look at the mess of their lives. You look at what they're doing. You look at how horribly lost they are. But they're better. We know that God spake unto Moses, verse 29. As for this fellow, we don't know where he came from. Amazing. He healed a blind man with the power of God. But they don't know where it came from. Amazing. The man answered and said unto them, herein is a marvelous thing. And I'm right there with it. And it is. I mean, it's something to marvel at. Something to be just amazed at. Herein is a marvelous thing. You don't know where he came from, and yet he opened my eyes. Incredible. But that's people. Persecuted for righteousness' sake. You can understand, as I close, I'll say this. I hope I'm not wrong in saying it. You can understand when people want to retaliate against wrong. I wrote about that in the bulletin this morning. You can read my thoughts on it. But you can understand it. Someone does wrong and someone wants to get back at them. I think that's understandable. Not right, but it's understandable. But when people persecute, punish, attack, offend another person for simply doing what's right, it's just beyond belief. And yet it is part of life. And it's part of the Christian life.